They are going for the drifts, Isor Gondele grunted as he came up and took over the point from Roland. We should radio ahead and set a patrol for them. There are 12 drifts, 40 miles. 1,000 men wouldn't do it. Roland wanted them for himself, all 9 of them. One look at his face and Isor Gondele realized that. He picked up the run of the spoor. They were crossing an open glade of golden grass. The chase had left a sweep line through the grass, the stems still bent in the direction of their flight, and the sunlight reflected at a different intensity from these. It was like following a highway. They went down it at a swinging, easy run, and ahead of him Isor Gondele saw some of the grass stems springing upright again. They were that close already, and it wasn't yet noon. They had cut at least 3 hours off the lead that the zebra carders had upon them.
We can catch them before the river. We can have them for ourselves, Isor Gondele thought fiercely, and resisted the temptation to lengthen his stride.
They could move no faster. An inch more in his stride would put a term on their endurance, whereas at this pace they could run the sun down and the moon up. At 2 in the afternoon they lost the spoor again. They were on a long, low ridge of black ironstone, and the ground took no prints. As soon as Isor Gondele lost contact, the line stopped dead and went into a defensive attitude. Only Roland moved up and knelt out on his flank, keeping good separation so that a single burst could not take them both.
How does it look?
Roland brushed the tiny Mapani bees from his eyes and nostrils. They were maddeningly persistent in their hunt for moisture.
I think they are going straight in. If they're going to twist, this is the place to do it, Roland answered.
He wiped his face on his forearm, and the greasy camouflage paint came away in a dirty brown and green smear.
If we cast ahead again, we may lose half an hour, Isor Gondele pointed out. 3 kilometers.
If we run blind, we may lose more than that. We may never make them again. Roland looked around thoughtfully at the Mapani forest along the ridge. I don't like it, he decided at last. We will make a cast. The two of them circled out beyond the ridge, and as Isor Gondele had warned, it cost them half an hour of their gain, but they did not make the cut. There was no spoor on the direct line that they had been following. The chase had turned. They can only have followed the ridge. We have a one-on-one choice. East is away from the drifts.
I don't believe they would chance it.
We'll run the western ridge blind, Roland decided, and they turned and went on harder than before, for they were rested, and they had the lost half hour to make up. Roland ran with doubt gnawing his guts and rocky black ironstone crunching under his boots. Isor Gondele was far out on his right flank, on the softer earth below the ridge, watching for the point where the chase left it and turned northwards towards the river again, if it ever did. Roland could not cover the southern edge of the ridge as well. The ironstone belt was too wide. It would mean splitting his meager forces. The south side was his blind side. If they had doubled or turned eastwards, then he had lost them. The thought of that was unbearable. He clenched his jaws until they ached, and it felt as though his teeth might splinter, and he checked his watch. They'd been on the ridge 48 minutes. He was making the conversion of time to distance in his head when he saw the birds. There were 4 of them, 2 brace of sand grouse, and they were fighting in that peculiar quick-winged slant that made their intention unmistakable. They're going down to water, Roland said aloud, and marked their descent below the treetops before signalling to Isor Gondele. The water was a pothole in the Mapani, a relic of the last rains. 20 meters in diameter, most of it black mud, trampled by the game herds to the consistency of putty. The 9 sets of man prints were perfectly cast in it, going directly to the puddle of muddy water in the centre, and then once again heading directly northwards towards the river. They were on to the chase again, and Roland's hatred burned up brightly once more. "Drain your bottles," he ordered. There was no profit in adulterating what remained of their sweet water with that filthy, coffee-coloured liquid in the pan. They drank greedily, and then one man collected their bottles and went out across the mud to refill them. Roland would not risk more of his troopers than was necessary out there on the exposed pan. It was almost 4 o'clock by the time they were ready to take the spoor again, and by Roland's reckoning, they were still 10 miles from the river.
"We can't let them get across, Sergeant Major," he told him quietly.
"From now on, we won't hold back. Push all out." The pace was too hard, even for superbly trained athletes such as they were. If they ran into contact now, they'd be blown, almost helpless during the long minutes it would take to recover. But they reached the Kazangula Road unchallenged. There had been no security patrol over the gravel surface for at least 4 hours. They found where the chase had taken the precaution of reconnoitering the road and sweeping away the signs of their crossing. That had cost them precious minutes, and the scouts were within an ace of contact. The patch of earth where one of the terrorists had urinated was still muddy wet. The sandy earth had not had time to absorb it, nor the sun to evaporate it. They were minutes behind. It was folly to go in at the run, but as they crossed the road, Roland repeated, "All out!" And when he saw the flicker of Isor Gondele's eyes as he looked back, Roland went on, "Take number two. I'll lead." He led at full run, hurdling the low thorn scrub in his path, relying only on his own speed to survive the first volley when they made the contact, knowing that even if the Turs took him out, he could leave Isor Gondele and his men to finish it for him. Survival no longer was important to Roland. All that mattered was to make the contact and destroy them, as they had destroyed Janine. Yet when he saw the flash of movement and colour in the scrub ahead of him, he went belly down from full run and made 2 quick rolls to the side to spoil the aim. He was onto the target an instant later and fired a short burst, one light touch on the trigger, and the FN hammered into his shoulder. Then as the echoes fled, there was complete silence. No return fire. And his scouts were down in cover behind him, not firing until they had a target. He signalled Isor Gondele, "Stay and cover me," and went up on his feet, keeping low, rushing forward, jinking and twisting. He dropped to the ground again beside a thorn bush. In the thorny branches above his head was the thing that had drawn his fire. It flapped again on the hot little breeze off the river. It was a woman's skirt, soft, fine cotton, bright buttercup yellow, but stained with dried blood and dirt. Roland reached up and tore the skirt off the thorns. He bundled it in his fist and pressed his face into the cloth. Her perfume still lingered, very faintly but unmistakably. Roland found himself on his feet, running forward with all his strength, with all his hatred, driven on by a madness that was at last out of control. Ahead of him, through the trees, he saw the warning markers along the edge of the cordon sanitaire. The little red-painted skulls seemed to taunt him, to goad him on. He did not check as he passed them. Nothing was going to stop him now. Ahead of him stretched the minefield. Something smashed into the back of Roland's knees, and he was thrown to earth, the wind driven from his lungs. But immediately he was trying to struggle up. Isor Gondele tackled him again, dragged him back from the edge, and they swayed together, straining chest to chest. "Let me go," Roland panted. "I have to..." Isor Gondele got his right arm free and crashed his fist into Roland's face, into his cheek, knocking his head across, half stunning him, then taking instant advantage of his shock by twisting his arm up between his shoulder blades and dragging him back. Clear of the minefield, he threw Roland to earth again and dropped down beside him, pinning him with one massive black arm. "You crazy bastard, you get us all killed," he snarled into Roland's face. "You were into it already, just one more step." Roland stared at him uncomprehendingly, like a sleeper waking from a nightmare. "They have gone through the cordon," Isor hissed at him. "They have got clear, it is finished, they have gone."
"No," Roland shook his head. "They haven't got away. Get the radio up here. We can't let them get away."
Roland used the security network. The calling channel was 129.7 megahertz. "All units, this is Cheetah One. Come in any station," he called quietly, but with the edge of desperation in his voice. The power on the set was only 4 watts, and Victoria Falls was 30 miles or so downriver. The only reply was the hum and burr of static. He switched to the aviation frequencies and tried Vic Fall's approach on 126.9. Still no reply. He clicked over to Tower and keyed the microphone.
Tower, this is Cheetah One. Come in, please.
There was a whisper, scratchy and faint.
Cheetah One, this is Victoria Falls Tower. You are transmitting on a restricted frequency.
Tower, we are a unit of Ballantyne scouts. We are in hot pursuit.
Cheetah One, is your chase the gang that sammed the Viscount?
Tower, that's affirmative.
Cheetah One, you have our full cooperation.
I need a chopper to lift us over the cordon sanitaire. Do you have one on the plot?
Negative, Cheetah One, negative. Only fixed-wing aircraft available.
Stand by.
Roland lowered the microphone and stared out across the minefield. It was so narrow. It would take 20 seconds to cross it. But it might have been the Sahara.
If they send a vehicle to pick us up, we can fly from Vic Falls and make a para-jump on the far bank.
Esau Gondele muttered beside his ear.
No, it's no good. It'll take 2 hours.
Roland broke off.
By God, that's it!
He thumbed the key of the microphone.
Tower, this is Cheetah One. Go ahead, Cheetah One.
There's a police armourer at Victoria Falls Hotel, named Sergeant Craig Mellow. I want him dropped on my position soon as possible to open the minefield. Telephone the hotel.
Stand by, Cheetah One.
Tower's thin whisper faded, and they lay in the sun and sweated, burned up by the heat and their hatred.
Cheetah One, we have Mellow. He's already en route to the field. We will make the delivery with a silver Beechcraft Baron. RUAC markings. Give us a position and a recognition.
Tower, we are on the cordon sanitaire, estimate 30 miles upstream from the falls. We will give you a white phosphorus grenade.
Roger, Cheetah One.
I understand white smoke marker. In view of SAM danger, we can only make one pass at low level. Expect delivery in 20 minutes.
Tower, we are running out of daylight. Tell them to hurry it up. For God's sake, those bastards are going to get clean away.
Esau Gondele had the grenade launcher fitted to the muzzle of his FN rifle. They heard the faint beat of twin aircraft engines coming from downstream, and Roland touched Esau's arm.
Ready? He asked. The sound of the engines built up swiftly. Roland raised himself into a kneeling position and stared into the east. He saw the flash of silver just on the treetops, and he tapped Esau's shoulder.
Now!
There was the crack of the blank cartridge, and the grenade lobbed up and over in a lazy parabola, fired away from the minefield towards the Kazangula Road. The grenade exploded, and a column of white smoke leapt above the brown, sun-seared bush. The small twin-engine aircraft banked gently towards the marker and then steadied again. The passenger door had been removed, leaving a square opening above the wing root. In the opening crouched a familiar, lanky figure, with the cross-webbing of the parachute harness coming out of his crotch over his chest and shoulders. The bulky chute package dangled low against the back of his legs. He wore a paratrooper's helmet and goggles, but his legs were brown and bare, and his feet were thrust into plain suede felskun. The Beechcraft was very low, perhaps too low. Roland felt a stab of anxiety. Sonny was no scout. He had done his 8 jumps for his paratrooper wings, but they were standard jumps from 4,000 feet. The Beechcraft was barely 200 feet above the bush. The pilot was taking no chances with incoming SAM fire.
Make another pass, Roland shouted. You're too low.
He crossed his arms overhead, waving them off. But as he did it, the wind-battered figure in the hatch of the Beechcraft dropped headfirst over the trailing edge of the silver wing. The tail seemed to slash at him like an executioner's axe, skimming his back, and the long ribbon of the ripcord flirted out behind him, still attached to the speeding machine like an umbilical cord.